And oh, are we till? Is it 1 hour, right?
Or 1.5.
1.5. Oh, yay! Cool. I'll use that.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming out. My name is Adam Shayla Frudenthaler. I'm a member of the Toronto Public Library Board, and I want to offer my thanks and my welcome on behalf of the Toronto Public Library and our board, and let you know that the Toronto Public Library is so very proud and excited to have the Comic Arts Festival here with us today, this weekend. I'm told it's the biggest arts-related comic festival in Canada. It really is. Yes, that is deserving of an applause. For this festival is a really natural fit for the library. Comics and graphic novels are an important and growing part of our collections at the library, and they're well used and loved by our patrons. We're always looking for fun and unique ways to promote all of our collections, but particularly this one, because people are so excited by it, and there really is just so much demand. I want to welcome all of our special guests from Canada, the United States, and indeed across the world. I'm told that we have folks here from Germany and other parts of Europe. It really is a pleasure to host you. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our partners at TCAP, specifically Christopher Butcher, Peter Perkmo, and all of the volunteers for putting on a fantastic lineup this year. I think we can agree that this is quite possibly the biggest one yet. So really, thank you. And now I'd like to introduce the person that we're all here for. It certainly isn't me. It's Scott McCloud. Scott is an American cartoonist and the creator of the lighthearted sci-fi and superhero comic book series Zod. Following the publication in 1993 of Understanding Comics, a wide-ranging exploration of the definition, history, vocabulary, and methods of the medium of comics, Scott is perhaps best known as a comics theorist. In 2000, he published Reinventing Comics, in which he outlined 12 revolutions that he argued would be key to the growth and success of comics. Finally, in 2006, he released Making Comics. Scott McCloud was one of the earliest promoters of webcomics. Today, he maintains an active online presence on his website, where he publishes many of his ongoing experiments with comics. Very much in demand, Scott created a comic book for Google in 2008 that explained the inner workings of their new open-source web browser, Google Chrome. And today he is here to answer all of your questions about his work and passion for comics. Please give him a warm welcome to Scott McCloud.
And just to fill it out, this is Mark Asquith, my friend and a long time, still sort of a nexus of many comics realities. One of the first, what we call Nexi, people who are the men at the crossroads, and a Toronto native, I think, for many years.
Right? Born in Toronto.
Born in Toronto. We'll be kicking it off. Has stepped in graciously at the last moment to kick this off with some questions from the podium, and then I guess open it up to you guys. And I have some images. Now, I just before we even start, I just want to say very quickly, I do have some images here, but because some people have seen things like my TED Talk, or even when I was here a couple of years ago, I sometimes have the 700 slide, like, crazy one after another show. That's not this. This is we have some images with us, but it's not going to... it's not one of those. I just have some stuff. If I need to show you some things, I have some things that I can show you. But a lot of the time, you're just going to see this or a blank screen while I talk. So.
And we also have this wall, which they graciously let Scott to draw on.
Sharpie.
So I think that's a good idea. So first, I want to start with that word that's behind you, comic. How do you define that word?
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing was, I took a page from Will Eisner's Comics and Sequential Art. He had been talking about comics and sequential art. He never really said comics are sequential art, but that was kind of the underlying message. And I was like, come on, let's get specific, Will. And so I felt, okay, comics are sequential art. I really feel like that's the way most cartoonists I knew were using it. So, and they had this pretty broad idea. A lot of the young cartoonists that I like, you know, if you said to them, hey, can you make a comic out of macrame? They'd be like, yeah, sure. I just, you know, make one little macrame over here and then another over here, and I'm saying, yeah, that's in sequence, and that makes a comic. So I came up with this crazy definition, which is comics are juxtaposed pictorial and other images in deliberate sequence.
Which is called the deluge of cartoonists after you.
Right, exactly. Oh, God. I mean, everybody was arguing with me from, like, Eddie Campbell on downwards. Oh, that's wrong. But I really like the definition. Of all the things that all the early theories and all that I think are, like, worth standing by, I stand by my definition, even despite the loopholes, because... What the thing? Okay. Oh, I get to use the Sharpie. Okay. I'm not going to be showing now how to draw Mickey or anything, but every once in a while it's good to, like, show something. Okay, so in 1993 when I did the book, this is like that all of comics history was sort of like, you know, okay, you know, we had superhero comics over here, and then there was, like, newspaper comics over here, and then there's Archie and Betty and Veronica, and then, you know, we knew that some stuff was going on in Europe, and Japan, we didn't quite understand how huge it was yet. It was really, really big. But there, okay, here's all of comics history, right? And now I come along and I say, no, it's got to be sequential art. You've got to put one picture in front of another to tell a story, and that describes all these different types of comics. But didn't describe a few. There was the Far Side. There was, like, Family Circus. What about the single panel people? And I was like, well, they're okay. All right, you know, I'm drawing this line here, and I'm, like, cutting a few people out. There are a couple. Ah, help! Here's Jeffy, right? So it's like I'm drawing this line, and I'm saying, okay, now all these things on this side, these are all comics, and you all know they're comics: comic strips, comic books, the just beginning of graphic novels, the stuff that was going on in Europe, the stuff that was going on in Japan. That's all comics. Far Side, not a comic. But it's cartooning, and cartooning is this rich tradition, and it overlaps comics in lots of ways, so that's wonderful. But it's not really comics, it's cartoon. And if you talk to those guys, they all say, we're cartoonists. You know, say, what do you do for a living? They'll say, I'm a cartoonist. And you don't say, they don't say I'm a comic book artist. So I think it was okay, but everybody was, like, really up in arms about this. They say, McLeod, you're drawing lines, you're boxing us in, you're making the medium restricted by cutting these people out and by, like, your boxes, your line, and all this sort of thing. And so I understand that. I understand that aversion to the idea of definitions. But the point was never that this is comics and this isn't comics. The point of the definition was this. That's what I was saying. I was saying, everything you know about comics so far is just this tiny little colony of possibilities on this, like, vast continent, or excuse me, of comics on this vast continent of possibilities. So all of a sudden, this opens it up, right? And you look back into history and you see things like certain pre-Columbian picture manuscripts or Egyptian wall paintings, certain Egyptian wall paintings, not hieroglyphics, that's something else. Or stained glass windows showing Stations of the Cross. And it was 1993, and I didn't mention computers once, but as soon as the ink was dry, boom, I was ready. And there were people at the beginning who said, oh, if it's on a computer screen, it's not a comic. You'll still find those people, not so many. But that definition allowed it.
Well, I was going to say, your definition did not talk about medium, which was really interesting. Yeah. And very early in the 90s, I remember a discussion between you, me, and Will Eisner talking about whether or not web comics should be allowed in the Eisner Awards. And interestingly, Will, who is, I don't know how old he was, 80-something?
He got
it immediately. He was like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
Because it's still comic.
Well, it was at Savannah College of Art and Design that they had a whole bunch of us down. I was there, Will Eisner was there, a whole bunch of other artists were there, Mike Mignola. And I remember we're on a panel, and there were, like, every artist there was on one panel, which is always a bad idea, by the way. There were, like, 9 or 10 of us. Nobody gets a word in edgewise. So somebody asked a question about web comics, and this was right around that time. And Will leaned forward and said, yeah, he didn't really think it was comics. And then they asked me, and I said, yeah, I do think it's comics, and here's why. And then it goes on to somebody else, and, like, while the other person is answering some completely different question, Will leans back his chair and, like, does this to me, and I lean back my chair, and we have this whole, like, little conference while somebody else is talking. Like, Eisner and McLeod are, like, being the assholes in the back are just, like, talking through it. And then he leans forward and said that we had had a conference, and he had changed his mind. But that Will was was like that. He was very open-minded about the whole thing. And you could talk to him. Dave McKean was in the audience when he said, "Oh, you can't make a comic out of photographs." And then we talked to him, and he's like, "Oh, I guess you can."
But that's one of the things that you did was kind of open up this territory and say to people, "Yeah, you could use doodles or macrame or
sculpture." International schools in China. One of the classes that I saw like 2 weeks ago, they were making sequential sculpture. It was great.
Okay, you have to prove it to me, Scott.
No. All you have to do is it's all about sort of the control parameters. You want certain things have to be a steady state. So what you do is you don't just make a whole bunch of like crazy sculptures. What you do is there are certain controlling elements. So like there was this one about culture shock. That was the theme. And these are international schools. So these are kids who are living in Shanghai, but they came from elsewhere. And these kids were from Korea. And they were doing this figure walking. So you have this little divider, these three square dividers, right? And inside there was these de facto panels. And you had a walking figure, and you had this him looking up, and then you had him looking down, and above him were faces spinning because the Koreans couldn't stand the fact that the residents of Shanghai kept spinning in the street. It was driving them nuts, and this was like really disturbing to them. And so like this big face is like spinning on top of the figure, and the figure is looking down. And we understood that, okay, the temporal axis then is as you're going left to right. There's this spatial construct, right, that's just the person and the face above him. And then we understand that as we're passing from one end of the sculpture to another, that's the temporal. That's we're going one moment, then the next. Of course it was comics. It was beautiful. It was done by middle schoolers, high schoolers, or whatever they were, in Shanghai, for Christ's sake.
I love the fact that Christ's sake and temporal are in the same thing. The other thing that you did with that trilogy, but particularly the first book, is you gave nomenclature. You gave us words. You gave cartoonists and people who write about comics ways to think about comics that we have often thought about but didn't actually have words for. Like, to me, it's the gap between the panels. You've got two panels. What's that thing? You know, the white space, I think I call
it. I didn't name it the gutter. That was actually, others had called it the gutter. And I was just all like,
you were the
low-hanging fruit metaphor. Let's go for it.
But you were the guy in the gutter. Yeah, but you were the guy who put all this stuff together, it seemed to me, that you kind of went out and kind of went, yeah, well, I like that one better, and I like that. What was sort of, for you, the key term?
The key term was actually the one I got wrong. Which is closure, which already existed, and I was using it wrong because I had a teacher in school who used it wrong. I think cognitive psychologists talk about like suture. I think it's sort of what I was talking about, which is this ability that we have to see the fragments and perceive the whole. So right now, for instance, you're in this room. You're looking at us talking up here. You know there's a wall behind you. Some of you are leaning against it, but those of you who aren't, you know there's a wall behind you because you're able to see the fragments, the part of the room that you can see, and understand that there's a room around that, and a library around the room, and a city around the library. Even as you're not seeing it, you're seeing it in your mind. You're perceiving the whole. That's what comics depends on. They depend on that ability to show you a world in fragments and allow you to perceive the entire world that those fragments are evidence of. And that's what I call closure, and that's kind of wrong. But it doesn't matter, because when you screw up like that, then they just eventually, 10 years later, some guy at the American Heritage Dictionary just goes, "Oh, fuck, all right, fine." It means that now. That's meaning number three, That's how words work. So I skewed it a little, but people were really kind of upset with me. Because closure means it's like, the story has closure, meaning it ended.
But one of the things we seem to be moving for today is talking about what the medium is. One of the things that fascinates me is, what things do you think the medium does best? Autobiography, explaining things like your Google Chrome comic did. Obviously in North America, superheroes have really kind of dominated. But does the medium drive us towards certain stories?
Well, this is the thing, is that for a while, there was this sense that comics naturally gravitated towards certain genres. The superhero genre, the notion that comics were naturally oriented to the spectacular, to the visionary, to that sort of thing. That's what we were saying, right? If you ask some guys, there at the Marvel or DC offices back in 1982, that's what they would have told you. But some of us were watching what was happening in Japan, where there were no superheroes. And what was happening in Europe, where it was all about world building and all. And the fact is that I came to understand that what really happens is that a few creative powerhouses Siegel and
Kirby changes the world.
Kirby, right? Hergé in Europe. Tezuka certainly in Japan. They just set the thing rolling. And there's, especially in physical markets where you're actually selling things and there's shelf space and you want to fill that shelf space with the thing that sold last time and all. They tend to perpetuate themselves in that. And really the truth is that you pluck a few creative individuals out of the history of any medium and that story of genre completely goes away. So I think that we can look at the types of comics that are out there as evidence of what the medium does well, but actually, in a way, it's really the evidence of the great arbitrary craziness of our history, that it just went that way. If somebody else had been there, it would have gone a different way. Now, that said, I think that comics are capable of much more than they've done. I do think that we've seen a little bit about what comics maybe are better at. Comics do have enormous potential for nonfiction because I think they map well to the way we remember things. Static images help you remember stuff. That's why they have the airline safety cards in front of you on the airline. It's because you remember how to, can you feel it, those of you who have flown, just close your eyes and just feel the emergency door thing that, right? You can just feel that because you've seen it in static images. You remember that stuff. So that's a big one. We're really good at that. We're much better at that than I think that our history has shown so far. On the other hand, we have to ask ourselves, why? Why, if comics in the 20th century began, we began about the same time as movies, the modern comic, you know, the stuff that grew out of the newspapers and all. Why have movies done better? They've done better. What's going on with comics? Where did we fuck up?
They got Spielberg and Cecil B. DeMille. We didn't.
Well, we had McKay early on. We had a lot of really good people. But I think part of it is, I'm not sure. I think that the thing is that, like, the seamlessness of escape that motion pictures offers us, comics, I think, were always going to be a little more gnarly than that because you still have the opacity of the artist's style. You still have the inconsistencies of it. You still have to work a little harder as a reader to make it feel real and immersive, right? Whereas I think in motion pictures, it's kind of automatic. Unless you've never seen a movie before, and of course they've done tests with people who have, and they're all like, I don't understand. But I mean, as long as you have some sense of the medium, the reality of it, good or bad, doesn't matter. You're in it. You're in it. You get it. It's around you. It's happening. Whereas with comics, you pick it up and the very first time you see a comic, it's drawings. And I really have to work at making it into life. And in fact, I realized that the reason why people sometimes on regular comic book series, you know, like the magazines, when their favorite artist gets replaced, or when the favorite artist changes styles, they get upset because all of their favorite characters have been replaced by drawings of their favorite characters. Right? Suddenly the style becomes opaque again, and it takes them a while to tear past that. So that, I think, is part of it, is that, but, you know, what do we get in exchange? What we get in exchange is a world filtered through the stubborn idiosyncrasies of the human hand and the human mind and the human heart, and that's kind of cool.
Well, I love books, I love novels, I love nonfiction, and there is a technology of that. You know, you have to put words in a row to put a picture in my head. And I love the technology of the novel and of the nonfiction book. Comics, of course, I love, but that image that I once created in my head in a novel is now in the hands of the cartoonist. In a way, I think it's wrong to compare comics to film and why that's done better. Why haven't we done as well as novels? They both use very similar technologies.
Novels and film are both seamless in their presentation. So there's no...
How are comics?
Comics are a call and response. I show you something to see right within the panels. All right, it's the old... Yeah, this Sharpie's the loser. But yeah, I show you something to see within the panel and then something for you to imagine between the panels. And it's always got a rhythm to it, whereas with prose, you're constantly creating as a reader.
No, but I think they're all call and response. If I read a novel and somebody says, the sunset felt like a daiquiri, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about that daiquiri color.
Yeah, but that call and response is call response, as opposed to comics where it's call, response, like that. You know, with film, it's even more. It's like, it's really fast. So it's fast enough to seem seamless. I mean, it felt just like the persistence of memory. Oh, okay. Well, you know, this is the old, thank you. This is sort of the way I reduced it in understanding comics was this, of course. It's this notion of
you know, the seen and the unseen. One of the cool things is the comics is a visual medium, right? We depend on the medium of sight, or the sense of sight, to deliver everything to you, where the other senses come into play is in between the panels. You imagine all, you have to employ all your senses there. And that's why when you have those disconnected, what I call aspect-to-aspect transitions that they use a lot in Japanese comics, that's where you can activate the other senses. You start to hear sounds, you start to smell smells, if your imagination is sufficiently provoked by what's in the panels.
Do you think that certain cultures move towards different rhythms of call and response? Certainly it seems like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the three great comics cultures, which are sort of the North American tradition, the Japanese tradition, and the Franco-Belgian tradition, the stuff they have in Europe, those are the sort of the great wellsprings for now. And each one of them has a different, completely different rhythm. I mean, like in Europe, as I say, because of Hergé, and remember, it all comes back to just like, there are just usually one or two artists who are responsible for that. But because of Hergé, the last 50 years of comics in Europe have been about world building. And they really have, all the way through Mobius and right up to David B. And you know, like Schwietman Peters and all those guys, they're all creating worlds. They may all have different agendas. Some of them may be political. Some of them may be about telling stories. But everyone is creating worlds. And so their call and response is much more about like sort of establishing shot. And everything is always, it's always like the richness of the creation of this world. And then in Japan, it's a very experiential. And there, that completely affects the rhythm because they have those disconnected images, those fragmentary images that you get that give you a sense of just encountering the world in fragments.
One of the things that I love about comics, and it's a weird thing to talk about, is that often an artist's line can be like a signature. You see a Chris Ware line, and it's very different from a Scott McCloud line, and I look at that, and something else seems to be communicated. As an artist, what do you feel about that, just that very simple idea of the line?
Well, it communicates like a wealth of abstract information. This is something we were talking about in the abstract comics panel this morning. It's just this idea that you can't really help but communicate a certain emotional energy, a certain synesthetic energy, just every time you draw a line. Any one of you could pick up a brush right now, make a line, just a single line up here, and we'd be able to look at those lines and we'd be able to say that one seemed louder, that one seemed more to have more conviction, that one of them seemed more wavering, and that each of these would inevitably provoke in us some kind of emotional reaction, even if it's very subtle. So when you're drawing an entire world, it's impossible not to convey something of your emotional state and provoke an emotional state in the reader through that world. So that's something to, you know, watch out for. Although I warn people against inventing a style, because that's never good. You should really just draw stuff, you know, and after you've drawn like 10,000 pictures, style just happens.
There's more theory to come, but I think that'll come out in the... No, but not for me.
More theory to come after the break.
But I'm not going to do that. I wanted to switch to something else, because we haven't really discussed your new project. Are you comfortable?
I can say a little bit. Not much, but I can say about some of the thoughts that...
Well, first of all, why a big thing? You said, told me it was going to be like 400 pages. It would be a big thing.
Yeah, I'm starting a graphic novel. It's going to take about 3 years. Two years, 8 months at this point. It's for first, second. It takes place in New York City. It's a story I've had in mind for 20 years. It's going to be around 400 pages. Over 20 years. Over 20. Yeah, Kurt had confirmed that because I talked to him about it ages ago.
Kurt Busiek. I need to be... I'll add the little index.
Right. I'll add the pronunciation, too. It's Busiek.
Sorry, Busiek.
That's okay. He's the second most mispronounced name in comics. The first one is Bill Sienkiewicz. But many of you may not, you've seen it spelled. You don't even know what I'm talking about because it sounds
S-I-E-N-K-I-E-W-I-C-Z.
Yeah, most people think it's like Sienkiewicz or something. It's Sienkiewicz. That's why in Cerebus, well, it's a thing. Well, he worships the god Kevich. That's it. It's a talk. Anyway, so
it's horrible as I get that joke.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The character Moonroach, which is oh god, whatever. Anyway, so. Oh God! Wait, hold on. The sculptor is the working title, and it's very operatic. It has very high emotions. It's about love and death and art and everything. It's about a lot of things, and I'm loving it. It's great. I've never been so excited about anything since understanding comics. That was the last time I felt this way.
Now, what's your process? Do you map out the story first? Are you drawing in images, or are you writing it in terms of prose?
I actually have an outline. I have a like really, really long outline.
Like a prose outline or a
prose? Yeah, just words. But when I start doing the actual story, like script, the script only happens in word balloons. I never write a script for myself. I know cartoonists who do that. It's so weird. It's like sending Semaphore to yourself to tell you how to lift the spoon to eat breakfast. I don't understand that. It's just like, now listen, artist. I want you to show me a long shot now. What? I mean, every once in a while I'll pull out the keyboard and do a little, test out some conversational snippets. But mostly I just lay it out. It's so that the words and the pictures at the same time. One thing that I was doing for a while, though, is I was actually taking 3x5 note cards, and I would do like a rough panel and then another 3x5 note card and another panel, because I wanted to start with the moments and say, screw the pages. I don't care where they fall on the page. First, I want to make sure that this has the right moments. And if this conversation should be 17 panels or 15 panels or 21 panels, I want to know that first. Then I'll figure out where they fit. That was interesting. It was very liberating. Don't always keep to that, but that was something that, I had a giant piece of foam core in my studio with all these little strips, and I could like slide them and like take them. And it's like, we should be able to do that, but pages screw things up. This is one of my grudges with print, and this is going to be a print book, so I'm already conflicted. But, why is it that when we choose the size and shape of panel 1 and 2 that we can't, that we've already restricted our size and shape of panel 3. Why? That's not right. It shouldn't be that way. That's not how it works in music. It would be like, there's some music program where it has like this metronome sound. It's like GarageBand or something, or some like freeware music creation program, and it has a little click, 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 and you have to hunt through the controls to like get rid of it. In comics, we can't get rid of the click. The page is there. It's this imposed rhythm. It's always there.
Are you going to do, in a way, some people who don't like that stick to a rhythm or stick to a grid?
Well, some stick to a grid. But this one I'm going loose. So it's like I'm driving myself nuts now because of that. Like Spiegelman, his latest thing, they're all the same size. So he can actually do the reflow thing, right? Doesn't matter where they fall, all the panels are the same size. It's just a 6 grid, 2x3. I like grids. Understanding Comics was a grid. Watchmen was a grid. I don't know how many people noticed that, but it's a 3x3 grid. So anytime
Dark Knight was a grid.
Dark Knight. Yeah, exactly. So the grids are cool because you have a control. When you control certain parameters, then you notice what changes. You can focus on what changes, and people just they ignore the rest.
In fact, Watchmen's a brilliant example because it really looked at that as almost as if the panel were a proscenium arch and said, if I give you two of those together, I've changed the music.
Exactly. I've been thinking about the proscenium arch a lot. Neil Gaiman was the first one like to sit me down with that.
From Alan. Neil wrote that.
Okay, all right. he probably gave credit. Come on, this was years ago. He probably said, Alan told me. Yeah, but this notion in theater, the proscenium arch, you'd be like, when the arch disappears, you only think about the story. You only think about the actors. But the funny thing is, I'm a formalist, right? So I was always making it think about, for 15 years, my entire career was like, dude, look at these arches! Right? Like, I made a new arch. I can make my arches diamond shaped. Check it out.
Let me objectify another panel border.
Exactly. Like, pay attention to this. Think about this. And now suddenly, I want to do that thing that formalists always want to do eventually, which is kind of the Mount Everest, the big challenge. For a formalist, for people who like to experiment, the biggest challenge of all is to create something that doesn't look like an experiment at all. I want to take everything I've learned and bury them in the sand. I want you to open up this new graphic novel when I'm done with it, and I want you to start reading and forget that you're reading by the time you're on page 2. And then I just want you to go, and then like, come out, and you've read the entire thing, and like you forgot what world you live in. That's what I want to do. I don't want you to be looking at panel borders. I don't want you to be looking at all the tricks. I don't want you to be thinking, why, that's a very clever technique that McLeod used. No! I don't want anything like that. I just want you to read it. I want you to read it because that's the thing every formalist really secretly wants, is to impersonate their opposite number. Right? That's what I have to do now.
Is there anybody you think who's really nailed that or in the history of the
media? Spiegelman did it with Mouse, right? That's what, because the stuff that Spiegelman did before Mouse was just so aggressively formalist. So it is recently collected in this book, Breakdowns.
Yeah. Brilliant book, by the way.
Oh, it's wonderful. I swear by that book. Every single comic you can read, you know, this one you can read in any direction. You know, this one is like, oh, look, all the panels are, you know, like the captions are for the panel that went before. Check this out. And you have to, it's hard reading. It's like I've taken a quiz, but they're really wonderful. And then he did Mouse. And Mouse, suddenly, it was all about transparency. And my editor at the time, Pat Ironwood, had visited Spiegelman while he was working on Mouse. And he had this caption in the shape of a railway ticket. And she was reading the draft of Mouse, and she said, I really like the caption in the shape of a railway ticket. And Spiegelman said, I'll take it out. And he said, and she said, no, you didn't hear me. I said, I liked it. And he said, yes, but you stopped reading. I mean, in Breakdowns, all that stuff, he wanted you to stop reading all the time. Now, this is only volume one, because after that he got into his whole meta. And he could only keep it in him for a book before the formless came out. And then suddenly he had panels like he goes to his psychiatrist, and his psychiatrist is from Poland, so the psychiatrist is a pig, but his psychiatrist has a cat. He owns cats, so there are cats there. And then Spiegelman says, can I mention this, or does it mess up my metaphor? Yeah, it was all there. Pretty soon he's wearing mouse masks, and he's talking, you know.
I know we've been playing fast and loose with some ideas, but one, this is kind of a weird one. You called yourself a formalist. And I remember we had a very interesting conversation. As some of you know, I worked on a film called Comic Book Confidential. Mm-hmm. And Ron Mann said to me one day, okay, your list of people that you want me to, you know, want us to interview is like 60 people. Could you get it down to about 12? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's impossible. Like the history of comics in 12 people. And I got on the King Street car, 504, taking it along, and suddenly it hit me. There were four. Kirby, Kurtzman, Crumb, and Eisner. Mm. Everything around that. And then Karl Barth somewhere off to the side.
Yeah.
But it made me think, Kirby, Kurtzman, Crumb, Eisner. Wow, there are four different ways of thinking about comics.
Oh, yeah.
And you came up with the same idea, but used different words.
Yeah.
Complete, you know, in understanding comics. So tell me about your different people. Where Kirby, Kurtzman,
well, my four, yeah, it was actually making comics. I finally published what I consider my toxic theory. And this is, it's this idea that the comics tends to like gravitate towards these four groups. Oh, are they in here? No, it's not that. No, go away. No, it's not that. Hold on. There's transitions here that don't belong. No, it's not here. Anyway. So, just look at this lovely page by Craig Thompson, except don't, because that's going to be super distracting. Okay. There's something else. Okay. Keep that.
There it is. I just did
perfect. Oh, yeah. Dude, oh, this has nothing. Mark's never going to ask me this question, so I'll just say, I just posted this on my blog. Dude, if you go to the top of the CN Tower and you take pictures, and then you, like, zoom in and you crop them, they all look like you're looking at The Sims. Because... right? Because the perspective lines are almost parallel. Do you look at those people? Do you expect to have little floating diamonds over their heads? Isn't that awesome? I love that. Anyway, so.
Ladies and gentlemen, a glimpse into Scott McCloud's brain.
It's not even a great camera either. You get a really good camera, you could zoom in even more.
All right, so my toxic theory was that, okay. First of all, a disclaimer, okay? I call it my toxic theory because it's really, really bad and evil to classify cartoonists. It's okay to start putting panel transitions in boxes. That's okay. But now we're talking about actual living, breathing human beings. So I want to say, straight up, there are as many types of comic book artists as there are comic book artists, okay? But there are certain campfires.
Because you were a formalist.
Because I'm a formalist. I have to put people in boxes. I have to. There are certain campfires that people tend to gather around, okay? And those campfires, there's really four of them in particular that huge clumps of people gather around, and they've made these de facto tribes. And they are the classicists.
Okay, give me an example of a classicist.
Well, the classic is Hal Foster. Right, so people who really worship Hal Foster, if you ever hear the phrase, Hal Foster is God, you're talking to a classicist. Now, many people have sort of majors and minors. For instance, I think that both Dave McKean and Craig Russell have some of this in them, but they also,
they skew in other directions as well, for example. So, but these are campfires that a lot of people cluster around. So the classicists, people who are really concerned about craft, beauty, who they feel like they're in a tradition of drawing. So for them, it's all about hard work, learning your craft, and this sort of this embedded notion that while perfection may not be possible in this world, there's no reason not to try. These are people whose work you look at it and you just say, this is astonishingly beautiful work. Why have I never seen this person before? That's what you think when you look at classes. A good one.
Lots and lots of drapery.
Lots of drapery, yes. And beautiful beard. And sort of, they tend to embrace a sense of beauty about like the human figure and human faces, which is in many ways reasonably universal. Like anyone could look at their character and say, what beautiful drawings, right? Okay. Then there are the animists. The animists are not so much concerned with craft unless it serves the story. The animists are people, Charles Schulz, I think, was one in many ways, although he also had a minor. Kirby, in some ways, is that. People who have a much more intuitive approach, who think, well, it can be all well-crafted, but it might just sit there. The important thing is that it's alive, that it breathes, that it has content, that when you, like I was talking about, this idea that when you start reading, you forget you're reading at all, and you just lose yourselves in the lives of the characters. These are the people, the pure, the gifted storytellers. They actually drive the industry in many ways. They're the ones who create such vivid characters and vivid stories that you just lose yourself. They put content first, right? Okay, so there's craft, there's content. Then, dorks like me. These are people who may enjoy reading these guys. They may enjoy their content, but they just can't get past the form. They love the form. They look at whatever art form they're in, and they think, this is a chance to play. And they look at everything that's being done, and they say, wow, everybody in this entire industry, in this entire art form, they're all doing this one thing, but they could be doing this other thing. Like the early days of film, where it was just like, dude, you could pick up the camera and do stuff with it. You don't have to have it sitting there in the front row. It doesn't even have to look like a play. You know, right? The formalist. So,
an interesting camp, too, by the way. I think Eisner can sort of fit into
Eisner is a patron saint there. Early Spiegelman, very formalistic. A lot of the early strip people. People like McKay had a lot of formalists, but a little classicist, too.
Do you think you get formalists early on in the creation of an art form more than you get it late?
Well, you know, the question is, which came first, the chicken or the egg? In a way, is the art form created, be it by these guys or by these guys? Are they storytellers looking for a way to tell their story, or are there people saying, hey, look, I came up with this thing, what do we do with it? And I don't really know the answer to that, okay? But they're useful. These guys are useful. Okay. So without these guys, though, you know, we'd all be still reading Mutt and Jeff. You know, really good mantra.
Spoken like a true formalist.
Well, yeah. Well, I was giving myself some nods, too. I mean, obviously, we have our problems. Like, for instance, the fact that we're so clever that everything we do just sits there, it's dead. And then, finally, the iconoclasts. These are people who are distrustful of an excess of craft, who are distrustful of people who just put their audience first and tell their audience what they like to hear. These are people who get annoyed in the bar when that guy keeps talking about comics. These are people whose highest value is honesty, is something that feels real, that feels honest and unpretentious, and just tells the truth, even if the truth is ugly, even if the truth is unflattering, even if the truth about themselves is grotesque. In fact, especially if the truth about themselves is grotesque, they want to tell the world. That's where you get Crumb. That's where you get,
in a way, Chester Brown.
Yeah, you got Chester. I mean, especially like right after the first Yummy Furs, and he started doing things about him sitting picking his nose for an entire issue. Iconoclastic impulse.
I think I was in that one.
Yes, you were. You were. And he drew your chin like really big for some reason. Anyway, so it's true. It's true. Mark was in that issue. I remember. Yeah, you came to visit, and then he lied about something, but then he knew you were going to be reading. Oh, that was the Playboy. You were in that one too. Anyway, so okay. So the values basically are beauty, content,
truth in the sense of like the real honest truth, and form, and oh my God, look, it's form and content. We're in art school, guys. Right? You have a dichotomy between form and content, and oh my God, beauty truth. Isn't that awesome? And this is like a tradition revolution dichotomy here from the top to the bottom, and then you have a kind of art life dichotomy here, and it's just like what happens in high school with the popular kids and the jocks and the freaks and the geeks. In movies and film, and you can pretty much, you know, it's a fun party game. But the reason it's worth doing, because remember my toxic theory, the reason why it's not totally evil is because wherever you are, first of all, you might not be born into, you may be raised by wolves. Like if you have artistic ambitions, it could be that all your friends, they're really onto the truth. The truth of comics is that it just takes hard work, and you bought that, and you really believe that it's all just about practicing your craft. But deep down in your soul, what you really want to do is just, you know, rip off your face and plunge into a vat of boiling piss and come out with some like truth about the world, but you just don't realize it yet. So it's useful that way.
Well, I think it's funny too that sometimes you get a situation where somebody is in a particular camp, like, you know, loves superhero comics, and then suddenly reads heavy metal, and their mind gets blown because, wow, this is a totally different way.
Which happened probably to both of us.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. About 17. Yeah. And then there was the breast didn't hurt. Yeah.
Breast, yeah. But I did want to just for fun. We're at a TCAF with about 200 artists. I wanted to talk about two or three and where they might fit in here. First of all, Emmanuel Gibert, where would you put him? I mean, there's a guy who could fit. He's moved all over this map.
Well, it's, you know, like, it, you know, it's too early for me to say, okay? I'm anyone who's only been around for 5 years in my world, in my comics world, I don't want to start classifying. In fact, really better if they're dead. Or really good friends, or just old.
All right, let's do a good friend who's been in the industry for over 20 years, Dave McKean.
Dave McKean, left side, definitely. In fact, he's like my poster boy for the classicist formalist. You know, there really is a standard. He's not doing conventional, you know, it's not about conventional beauty here. It's about a standard of beauty, though. And if you've been to his house, which, by the way, is like this old converted farmhouse.
It's actually an Oast house.
An Oast house, right. And his address doesn't even sound like an address because it's got this weird old English sound to it.
Oast house, stone come ebony.
You see?
Near Tenterden.
That's an address. I wasn't going to say it in case there was like a stalker in the audience. But, and it looks like if Frank Lloyd Wright had been raised by trolls. But you look at all
his bed has trees in it.
Yes. But all of the artwork, as aggressive and formal and inventive as it is, all of the artwork you see from all these other friends, other people that he likes, and Baron Story, very important artist for him, you can see, oh, it all adheres to a certain standard of beauty and excellence. There's similarities there. They are going for a standard. They're not just completely trying to break the mold. A formalist would make sure that they had 36 pieces of art hanging in their house that none of them look anything like any of the others. You know? That would be sort of the formalist thing. We're chameleons. Our stuff is dead on arrival, but we make good old men. That's the thing that formalists do, is like we're still curious when we're 90.
But you see, I look at somebody like Will Eisner, and I go, he fought all the time, he tried to animate his work, and he played around with that, tried to do that. He was never really an iconoclast.
Never an iconoclast. In fact, right. The iconoclast never quite knew what to do with him.
Or he with them.
Yeah, he would. He loved them. See, these guys always love these guys.
Yeah, Will loved Crumb.
Spiegelman loves these guys. Spiegelman is like these two together, but this is like the part he sort of like is always nurturing, his iconoclastic side. The guy created the Garbage Pail Kids, for God's sake. Right? But he's always a formalist at heart, so they never completely trusted him. And he would like, you know, he went next door to like S. Clay Wilson or somebody, and like he went next door to talk about art, and Wilson just wanted to talk about cars and women.
We didn't understand because, like, the iconoclast is all about life. Remember, this is the art life side. We should stop. This
well, one more, because Brian Lee O'Malley,
Brian Lee O'Malley. As you see, Brian Lee O'Malley, I just want to talk about which band he is.
Oh.
That's a
what band is Brian Lee?
Well, actually, he's a hybrid. He would be Pizzicato 5 plus Go Team, although I'm beginning to think you'd have to throw in a little Ting Tings.
Okay.
Craig Thompson is Suffian Stevens, by the way. I'll do this quickly, I promise, because they have questions too, but... okay, all right. Craig Thompson is Suffian Stevens. Will Eisner is Duke Ellington. R. Stevens, Rich Stevens, who does Diesel Sweeties, is Daft Punk.
He's here today.
Yeah, he's here. He's here on the floor. I thought, for a while, I was saying Eleanor Davis of Drew Wang and Eleanor Davis, you know, they live in Athens, Georgia. I was saying she was Johanna Newsom, although she has a lot of variety. So I'm not sure. James Kochalka is the Flaming Lips. Somebody said that Alex Toth is Chet Baker. I like that one. I'm not sure. Dan Clowes, R.E.M. But no, but the important one is that Ryan North, who does dinosaur comics.
Toronto cartoonist right here.
Toronto cartoonist right here. Sky, my daughter, suggested that he was the Ramones because the only thing that ever changed was the words. Because... But I'll get off that.
Yeah, and on that note, I think we'll open it up to questions. I can't stop that. So does anybody have a question for Scott?
Did you dare?
Yes, sir.
Hi, my question is about comics being turned into movies.
Mm.
Do you think that they're helping the industry at all? Or injuring the industry?
Well, first of all, congratulations on fulfilling the mandate of the panel, which is frequently asked questions. And that is, in fact, that's definitely one that a lot of people are asking right now is okay, what about what's going on with comics and movies? My answer is this. I think, first of all, if they make a movie out of a comic, my first hope, my most fervent hope, is that it will be a good movie. And I don't care if they throw away everything from the comic. I don't believe in being faithful to the comic unless it really serves the film. So I loved Chris Nolan's Dark Knight much more than I liked the Watchmen film, even though I think Watchmen is the better comic by far. I shouldn't say it that way. That's going to come out wrong. I think Watchmen, to me, is my favorite of the two. And yet Watchmen was totally faithful. I mean, that was about as faithful as could be expected in anything less than a 10-hour BBC miniseries, right? Okay, so very faithful, and yet Dark Knight, the better film. Why? Well, Chris Nolan is a really good filmmaker, and he and his brother wrote a terrific script, and all the acting was really good. Christian Bale doesn't have to go far to do Rage, apparently. So it's a great film. You know, like the best example for me is Ghost World, where Dan Clowes co-wrote the script for Ghost World with Terry Zwigoff, and he changed all kinds of stuff. It's a very different film from the original comic, because I assume he felt it would make a better film if it wasn't just slavishly imitating the comic. So that's the thing. I think one of the good things about the Hollywood flirtation with comics right now is people are starting to get the message that, oh, that's from a comic, that's from a comic, that's from a comic. And they realize, wow, comics are a whole lot of different stuff. I didn't know that. I mean, A History of Violence was from a comic. Road to Perdition was from a comic. So that's wonderful. It's showing the variety of comics. Also, it doesn't hurt that, you know, more cartoonists are making money off options. Will Eisner said that he hoped that that the Spirit would be optioned every year of his life, and that they would never make the movie. And somewhere in heaven, hopefully, he doesn't know that. Although I have to say, Ivy and I actually enjoyed The Spirit, but for reasons that I probably shouldn't go into.
But I do want to say, as a former retailer, as somebody who is friends with a lot of people who make movies, I mean, sorry, and people who make comics, just to use one example, for many, many years, Watchmen sold between 20 and 22,000 copies of the graphic novel per year. Mm. 3 years ago, they sold 75,000 copies. And the day after the Watchmen trailer opened before Dark Knight, they sold 600,000 copies before the weekend and 1 million copies by the time San Diego rolled around.
That's right.
That movie trailer not just the movie trailer sold a million copies of Watchmen, which is more copies of Watchmen than had been sold in the 20 years previous.
Yeah, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, because my major complaint with the Watchmen is the fact that it doesn't have that Smashing Pumpkins song going over the entire film. That is the most awesome trailer I've ever seen in my life. I love that trailer. And I was very conflicted.
But I love the fact that that movie trailer and that movie turned people on to The Watchmen.
Which is, to us, is one of our... Ever.
It was the greatest, you know, $150 million ad for a comic ad.
It was magnificent, yeah.
Yeah, so I...
Vegas sold another $2 million or something. It was just amazing numbers.
Yeah, and I think that people read The Watchmen and it changes comics. Because people, if you like The Watchmen, it'll get you thinking about how comics work. So I'm all for this.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's an absolute good.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hijack that part.
No, that's cool.
Yes, sir.
I just got a comment to what you're saying. A lot of people have asked Spiegelman why he hasn't, you know, sold the options to Mouse, you know, an animated film or whatever. And his theory was that, yes, maybe leading up to the film, he would make some more money, you know, selling more books and all this kind of stuff. But I'd be really curious to know, like a month or two after the Watchmen, what the sales figures are now. In other words, the touchstone for that piece of work is going to be the hierarchy that we have in North American culture, which is film is the ultimate expression of whatever art, whether it's a really good novel or a really good comic. And now it's like, oh yeah, you want the Watchmen experience or whatever it is, you're gonna, you know, look at the DVD. I mean, how many of these books are gonna go out the door?
It continues to sell. This is the wonderful thing. And people came out of the Watchmen and they complained about it. I gotta say though, weird digression. That motion comic, which is every single panel from the whole thing, what's that about? Like, that's just wrong.
No, that's period.
Yeah, that.
I'm sorry. I'm sure a lot of good, honest, hard work went into the creation. I'm sure there were good people involved in the creation of the Watchmen motion comic, but I don't know. I want to show it in my talks and have, you know, on Facebook, where like your friends do the little, they click a button and then you have the little thumbs up that says, you know, Darren likes this. Right? I just want to have a little thing in my talks where I show the Watchmen motion comic and then I have a little thing that just says, Hitler likes this. I have strong feelings about the Watchmen motion comic.
Yeah. I'm also hoping that Scott Pilgrim, which is being shot here in Toronto, I hope when that movie or that trailer comes out that it sells a lot of copies. That would be nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's talking about basically every trailer should have that same Smashing Pumpkins song.
Yes, sir.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your 24-hour comics.
Sure, yeah.
For a while, it seemed like a bit of a phenomenon that was taking on, but it seems to kind of fly to town, although it's still one of the best introductory ways to discover reading your own comics.
Yeah, the 24-hour comic, just for those of you haven't heard of it, back in 1990, I dared my friend Steve Bissett to draw a comic in 24 hours. He was really slow. I was really slow. But I'd seen him sketch at conventions. This guy's really fast. So I challenged him. And I said, okay, we're going to make a pact, like a blood pact, that we're going to make, each of us is going to make before the end of the month, August, I think it was, before August 31st. Is that second break? Yeah. Before August 31st, we're going to make ourselves a comic in one day. It's going to be 24 pages. So I did mine, and I found out that Steve had crapped out and not done his on August 31st, so I was all alone. So I did mine, but then he did his on August 36th. But then he sent it to a friend, and then like that, he sent it to Dave Sim, he sent it to Neil Gaiman, they did theirs. Dave started promoting it at Cerebus, and now there have been thousands and thousands of these things. And then 24-Hour Comics Day started in 2004. And they're still doing it. It's still an annual event. Actually, the last one was in, like, 29 countries. So who knows? It may continue to grow. But the thing about the 24-Hour Comics, I like speed exercises, because the thing is that for comic book artists, our problem is, hey, I had an idea. And they're like, 6 years later, you know, the guy's wife or husband is like, yeah, hey, how's the idea coming? It's like, almost done with page 96. It takes a really long time to draw your ideas. But in 24-hour comics, your hand might actually go faster than your brain. It's just like, I'm drawing this panel, I don't know what happens next. I'm drawing the next panel! But that's really cool, because then you have to call in that creative backup generator of the subconscious, and you start to discover things about yourself that maybe you shouldn't have known. But you discover stuff.
you discover stuff when you do that, when you work really, 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 really fast. And I think that's cool. It's good for the soul. And a lot of cartoonists just do them like every year. They just do another 24-hour comic. And it's just, I don't know. I've only done one because I only do anything once because I'm one of these guys, and that's what we do. We do everything once.
Yes, sir, in this right shirt.
I'm one of the European visitors that was mentioned earlier, and I have a question related to what you said about the different traditions, European and North American. And because to me it sounded like you were talking about the past, but I'm wondering, to what extent do you still see a difference in storytelling, the structure and so on between European and North American artists, and to what extent is that getting more and more blurry or disintegrating, or to what extent not?
I do think it is beginning to blur. Actually, I could show you one of my things. Like, for instance, the transitions were just accidents. Sorry, I was pulling from other talks and I realized, now I have all these long blurred transitions that'll take forever to get through. One of the things is like that we're starting to see a lot of the kind of experiential transitions that you see in manga. Still today, you see this a lot in manga, but we're starting to see them more in North American comics. Starting, I think, about 15 years ago, I think is when the blurring got more aggressive. So you have people like Craig Thompson, and here's Akiko Johnson, and showing these sort of aspect-aspect transitions. This is Craig Thompson here. So I think there's much more of both a Japanese sense of creating a sense of experience and creating a sense of the point of view of the protagonist. The notion that in Japanese comics, the most important thing is to make you feel as if you're in the middle of the story, the middle of the emotions, the middle of the sensations, the middle of that sense of place. And then you're just simply experiencing all that it is around you. So if there's one phrase that, to me, that sums up Japanese comics, it's the phrase, "You are here." And that's true from Tezuka on up, right up to the present day. And in European comics, I think in large part because of Hergé, I think that the one thing that binds together these very, very different generations of European creators in the Franco-Belgian tradition was the sense of world building. And that goes up to about David B. It is blurring. I think it is definitely blurring. And if there's one North American factor, because, you know, we have it too, we have certain things that distinguish North American comics, I think it's the primacy of the figure, that figure-ground relationship and the notion of the protagonist, the notion of that, the lone figure in background, and the sense that the character is almost like on a stage, that there's a backdrop, but it's all about the character and that there's a relationship between the character and the audience. And I found that characters in North American comics, they tend to keep their eye on the reader. They don't turn their backs. That's beginning to change. We're beginning to see in the North American tradition, this is a Hawaiian cartoonist, Akiko Johnson, is from the Night Fisher. We're finally seeing the backs of our characters, and we're starting to see the kind of panel transitions that typify Japanese comics. All in the last 15 years. I often went to Seth and his graphic novel, It's a Good Life If You Don't Weaken, and how he was willing to spend 6 pages on the changing of the seasons. Very Japanese, but also very European in the sense of building a world, taking the time to build the world. So when you look at somebody like Miyazaki, who's an internationalist, what you see there is a Japanese creator, but you look at his manga, and what is he doing? He's also world building. He's very much a world builder. And if you look at things like Mount Nausicaa, you see a European influence. Hell, it looks like he's been looking at Mobius. I assume there's some kind of direct link there. It's blurring. It's blurring, but a lot of that blurring has happened in the last 15. And I'm seeing more Western influence in the Japanese scene. Whoops, sorry. Well, anyway, cool. Here, I'll show you this. We're in the North American tradition. I think a lot of cartoonists, this is Meredith Grant's Octopus Pie, a lot of cartoonists are beginning to unpack. When we talk about decompressed storytelling, we're beginning to understand that we can look at the small moments of life and really focus it on these details. This also has a little bit to do with changes in gender as well. I think that attention to small details of human relations is something that's now considered worth depicting. And I think when it was a boys' club, I think we tended to gloss over a lot of those things.
But yeah, that's it. I mean, it's those three. It's really interesting. Look at North American comics and notice how no matter what's going on, you always have a sense that the protagonist knows you're watching and is staying close to the middle of the panel. There's something marvelous about how younger cartoonists in North America and how cartoonists in Japan for a long time and in Europe have been willing to sort of say, you know, I'm going to be over here. Come along if you like. You know, you have this big panel, right? And you have a character whose back is towards you, and they're just like running away from you. And you're like, where are they going? And you just like, you step over the panel border. But in America, it's for a long time, it was just like, yeah, hey, how you doing? Hey, here's me in the panel, hey! You know, I showed a two-page spread from Spider-Man, and there's like this big basketball game, and like there were like 100 characters all in that spread, every single one of them. I got your eye on you. Hey, hi. It's like, you know, you're on TRL or something. Hey! and that's changing, thank God, because I think it needs to change. But why? Why in North America did we do that? I think the reason was it goes all the way back to our birth in the womb of vaudeville. The American comic strip born out of theater and the idea of like, hey, I've got a comedy routine. It's just me. It's just me here in my bowler, and this guy's gonna get hit with a banana, you know? And behind us is a big drawing of a house, you know? Vaudeville. We began in theater. There's a little bit of theater left in North American comics, and that changed everything. Anyway, so that's... Or not. I don't know. Maybe I'm completely wrong.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the understanding comics and the impact it's had outside of comics. I know I had a panel on puppetry of all things a couple of weeks ago, and someone mentioned how some of the stuff about understanding comics relates, and some of the audience actually said, well, they're like, oh my God, Scott McCloud isn't it?
Puppetry, I bet. What's really freaky is that's not even the first time I heard about it in relation to puppetry. The first were the interface designers, then the web designers, then the game designers. And it just never really stopped.
You forgot academia.
Academia. Well, yeah. Well, they're not always that happy with me. It's like, you know. Oh, well, I won't get into that anyway. So, but yeah, other fields. I think part of it is, especially with when it comes to new media, things like interface design and game design, they haven't been around long enough in many respects. At least in their newest incarnations, in the new technology incarnations. They haven't been around long enough to have foundational texts that are within their field, because their field's relatively new. So they reach outside. A lot of them were influenced by things like Edward Tufte's book on information design, things like the visual display of quantitative information, which is a really great book and not nearly as intimidating as the text sounds, although it's good to say that at cocktail parties because it sounds really impressive, but it's actually extremely entertaining. Or Donald Norman's books on design, or, you know, who knows, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance or whatever. These are like things that come from outside of the field to like water. I mean, like, we weren't pointing to a lot of seminal comics texts in 1915, so it's not surprising that, you know, game designers are looking outside for other texts. So it's benefited from that. But mostly, I think the thing is that if you take any one topic and you concentrate on that topic, no matter how narrow the topic is, if you give it the full force of your concentration and passion, you will find yourself talking about a world on the other side. There's always something much broader to be discovered when you look at any one thing with sufficient passion, and you know, even if it's just, you know, charts. It's in the case of Edward Tufte. How are we doing? Have I just like eaten up the
whole thing? No, we have 17 more minutes.
Oh, okay.
Probably more like 12.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I believe you talked about, I guess, in relation to like webcomics and stuff, where it's become possible, but the idea of integrating like maybe short animations or even sound effects into comics, and I'm wondering if you take that to its extreme and start having maybe like snippets of full motion video or something, does it stop being comics or does it matter?
Like, for example, the Watchmen motion comic, which is, did I mention, pure evil. It's an evil, evil comic. Okay, well, here's the thing. Okay, what happens is that, okay, we've got, the experience of comics is this. Go panel 1, panel 2, panel 3, panel 4. However you arrange them, it's basically that what you're saying is that as you move through space, you're moving through time, right? So this is sort of what you might call the temporal axis. Okay?
So as you move from one space to the next, you're moving from one moment to the next. That's the fundamental nature of comics. It's true of comic strips, comic books, all the rest, okay? What happens is when you introduce sound and motion, autonomous sound and motion, where it's just like, click here to see Spider-Man jump over the wall and punch the villain, you know, and then click over here to see another movie. What you're doing is, instead of representing time through space, you're representing time through time. You're breaking with the axis. You're saying, okay, we're on one axis, and now we're breaking to this other axis. And when you do it, you rip open the fabric of the medium in such a way that you remind people of what they're looking at. They become aware of the medium of transmission, and they forget the content. So that becomes a problem.
Being a formalist or something? I mean, you're
now, this is true. Even if all you're doing is you're looking at it as a story, the point is it's just like you're watching a drive-in movie and suddenly a plane flies by, and now you remember, oh, there's this big rectangle that they're projecting on. It confronts you with the nature of the transmission of the information, so it screws it up, so you can't lose yourself in the story anymore. What's interesting, though, is that loops sound and motion in things like webcomics can actually work because they actually represent a steady state. And if you have a little loop of sound, ambient motion, cycling motion, then what you're saying is you're sort of coming back to the same point again and again and again and again. And then that's not as disruptive. So I think that there's a place for sound and motion, but I think it's dangerous to go to the full motion. Because the thing with the Watchmen motion comic and stuff like that is basically what they're saying is, hey, wouldn't it be great if it was moving, and then you had just one frame, and then it filled the frame, and then it was kind of everybody was moving around, and then like when somebody said something, you could have voice actors reading the word balloons. You wouldn't even need word balloons. It would just be like moving and making sound all the time, and wouldn't that be a really great comic? And it's like, wait a minute, I think we have a name for that, you know, and it's different. But there's all this crazy shit going on with interface that, like, the thing is that you can take this, and you can take it all the way. If I want to show you 300 panels, why can't I just put them all out on one giant canvas? And that's why, that's what I was talking about back in the 90s, and now we have things like Sea Dragon coming along, and people actually trying this out. Along with there's an infinite canvas application actually at Microsoft that's still very raw and interesting. But then other sort of continuous space metaphors like this thing Prezi from Hungary, and that has nothing to do with anything. But anyway, it's a thing. Oh, I better stop now. Congratulations on opening Pandora's box, though.
Yes, ma'am.
Would you speak, please, about web teaching comics for children?
Now, comics used for education through the web?
Yes.
Well, I think the comics have tremendous potential for education because, as we were mentioning earlier, I think that one of the things that helps us to remember very important information is that it's attached in some way to static imagery. This is why airline safety cards are so powerful, is because we remember through symbolic imagery. There are various, we were talking earlier about the fact that there are mnemonic devices specifically to help people to remember things that rely on static images. They come up with certain images to attach to certain items and people will remember them. And so I think comics have a tremendous ability to teach fairly abstract concepts very effectively, even to small children. And in fact, I found that when I was talking about the things I talked about in Understanding Comics, that I was able to address issues that if they had just been text, that people in college would have had difficulty under following some of what I was saying. And yet now, because it's in comics form, people in high school were able to follow the stuff in Understanding Comics. Some in middle school, I've heard from.
So what's the driving force? How do you catch the interest?
Well, I think the important thing is that the person doing it has to have the interest to begin with. The greatest trap for using comics for nonfiction is that you might fall into one of two camps. One of them is form apologizing for content, and the other is content apologizing for form. Form apologizing for content would be something like the Teen Titans Say No to Drugs, you know, where it's a comic book, but it's embarrassed that it has this, what it considers a bitter pill of a message. So they dress it up with a story, and then they eventually drop in that, oh, by the way, kids, here's what we have to tell you. So in other words, the underlying assumption is that the information is not interesting, that it needs to be sweetened, the idea of the sugared pill. That, I think, is a mistake. I think you should believe in the message, but you should also believe in the form. Content apologizing for form is when an organization, say, has some informational mission, wants to bring it to, say, school children, and then uses comics but is afraid to employ all the tools of comics and wants to make sure that it doesn't look too comic booky. And so they'll have very staid, concerted illustrations with blocks of text and not necessarily use comics form to its fullest. I think that one who uses comics for education should believe in the message and believe in the form and use them both to their best effect. And I think the results then can be really quite spectacular in how much information can be conveyed.
And it's an interesting caption to that. Will Eisner, one of the great formalists that we mentioned earlier, he worked at PS Magazine and used comics to show how you could, you know, clean a rifle.
For decades. And it's because of that sort of work that I could take Google's browser Chrome and actually show laymen how their multiprocessor architecture was useful in leading to the sandboxing of, you know, like different processes and things like that. It's fairly abstract stuff that I could just show you so that you could pretty much just reach out and touch it.
Alvin?
When you were talking about tearing the fabric, I was thinking of interactivity. Can you speak to that specifically?
Yeah, interactivity to me is not in any way incompatible with comics. Some of the early interactive comics, though, it was like, okay, here's the panel we're on now. This is now. This is the panel we're just on, and here's the panel we're going to. And some of the early interactive comics, the idea was, okay, now if you click on this, I'm sorry, and there would be like two branches, or like three, click on this and you can go somewhere else. The thing is, that betrays the nature of the comics, because comics, the branches should be visible. So the really interesting part is when it goes like this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then it just keeps going and going and going and going and going, and you see all the branches at once, because that's what comics does. Unlike all the other media, comics is the one medium where it's not just now, but you can actually rise above that temporal landscape and look down at the nature of the way we all live, which is we live in this landscape of time. You're actually gazing down at the fourth dimension. That's the beauty of comics, is it allows you to do that. And so in interactivity in comics, the point is that your choices should be visible. They should take a physical form, a visual form. And if you have 700 different choices, you ought to see 700 different panels. Just dive down and navigate through them. But some forms of interactivity, I think, start to get into other territory, which raises tensions, but it's complicated. I don't know that I could really get into that. That's a whole other talk. The problem with when I start talking is I realize that, oh my god, that's another 40 minutes, and let's not start that one. Okay.
I think we have room for one, maybe two more questions. So, yes, sir, in the hat.
See, I'm using comics a lot in education right now, and I'm doing it in high school, and the biggest problem I'm running into is they're now starting to go and say they're censoring it because of the still images, because you can see it. Mm. When they read about it, they can create their own context, they can create their own images, and that seems to be fine.
Yeah.
If you give them the image, you know, whoa, 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 you can't have two people lying in a bed together. You can say two people are lying in bed together, but the visual of it, I just got V for Vendetta shut down for me. And the reason wasn't the violence, but it was an image of a man and a woman in bed. And that's what they said was a big thing.
Yeah.
And it's the still image. How do I get them to start to grasp the concept that, okay, it's the same thing when you tell them it, they just create it, right? What's the big deal about showing them it?
I don't know if there's a way around it. I mean, there's no question that images are more inflammatory in some ways. I mean, it's one thing to get kids reading Catcher in the Rye. It's another thing to get them to look at it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. This is my most exciting question or answer of the night. I don't know. But it's a good question.
Yeah, like, it's your book. I got that, no problem. I've got Road to Perdition, no problem.
Yeah.
But
my next book will have nudity. That'll be a problem.
Yeah, so I won't even put it in the library then, right?
Yeah, Blankets has a problem.
They put it on a shelf behind the librarian, so you have to embarrass yourself to go and get it, right? And ask for permission. Can I read this book, ma'am? And you know, it's kind of like,
yeah, that is sad. Yeah, no, not Maxim. No, the thing next to it. Actually, that's a bad example. Maxim is softcore, isn't it? I don't know. Okay. Does anyone know? It doesn't matter.
Yes, sir.
What's your take on mobile comics or comics on mobile devices and where do you see them going?
Oh yeah, well yeah, I.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's. I have a slide, don't I?
Yes.
This is sort of related to that. You know, I. It's tricky. One of the things that. Oh, yeah. What? Actually, I'll go back a bit. This is really cool, but I'm probably not going to get to show it anyway. That's kind of cool too. Here we go. This is the Kindle. This is not probably not what you meant by mobile device, but this is related. I just did a blog post, and I got a lot of trouble for this. Actually, this is one of the first times that I put up a blog post, and virtually everybody who logged on to post was like, "Scott, I love you. You're wrong." And that was I was just saying that the shape of print is inherently landscape, just like everything else. It should be sideways because we've got two eyes next to each other. That's why print is usually two pages next to each other, because it fills your field of vision. And this idea that the shape of print is naturally this upright rectangle is wrong. And like I said, everybody disagreed with me, but this was the illustration I put up. You know, this idea that no, Kindle, wrong Kindle. Of course, you can rotate it, but it's another thing. It really isn't about the Kindle. What it really is about is just that you'll go and wonder, what was that? The old lady, the exact old lady, what's that happening? What's cool is that, nevertheless, I do think that there's something very spatially friendly about interfaces like multi-touch displays. The first ones that we had were like, the first prototypes we had were very complex and large, and then they've arrived in consumer devices like this. The thing is that some of the continuous space metaphors that I think are really potentially interesting for comics might actually map okay to those, and what's really cool is that they're probably going to get bigger. Apple just ordered a bunch of 10-inch touchscreens. We'll see where that leads. Is it going to be like a big iPod? Is it going to be a small netbook? Is it going to be a laptop? What's it going to be? But we've been really waiting to see that sort of multi-touch thing come on. Because really, the fact is, scrolling sucks. And I had to depend on scrolling for a lot of my early experiments in webcomics. And the idea that you might be able to just reach down and push, I like that. I like that a lot. So let's see where it goes.
Well, I think we've run out of time. It's about 26 after. Would everybody join me in thanking Scott McCullough?